world is so awash in lies.
The notion that there is such a thing as moderates fighting both the Assad government and the Islamic State, who we should be supporting, as is big a myth as there are Palestinians who should be giving a state of Palestine. When we speak of peoples that do not exist and talk about strategies on behalf of myths, and such can be spoken on a program like this where the news, SRN, which is a Christian news source, can misinform people in this way. It's no wonder so many people are lost. There never has been, and there never will be, a moderate who's going to go up against the Assad regime. If you're a moderate in Syria, you are praying to whatever God or not God you might have that Assad remains in power. Because if you're a moderate and the Muslims on either side, whether they be fundamentalist Shias or Sunnis, prevail, you're dead. And you know it. So if you're a moderate, A, you're no longer a Muslim, and B, you're rooting for Assad, just as are all Christians. They're annihilated should Assad fail. It is just moronic to promote this myth in Syria and how it's become pervasive in the political speak of the West, from the Obamanator to Hillary Clinton to Senator John McClown, throughout, ubiquitous, and throughout Europe as well. We need to recognize that all good Muslims are terrorists. That while there are many Muslims who think they are Muslims, but haven't a clue what Muhammad was like or what the Quran actually says, and may come across as nice people only because they're rotten Muslims, 100% of those willing to act as jihadists, willing to engage with the Islamic State, willing to pick up a gun to kill on behalf of their religion, are devout. In the first hour, we exposed the fraud that was Muhammad, beginning with his initial revelation. We pointed out that it was a horrific experience. We pointed out that the statements that emanated out of that from these alleged God were moronic. We indicated that the recipient of the first revelation recognized the spirit was so dark and demented that they admitted being demon-possessed. Now, you may think I'm still talking about Muhammad, but I'm not. Now I'm speaking of Paul. He has multiple, variant, conflicting accounts of what happened on the road to Damascus. But in all three accounts, he admits that the experience was horrific, that it blinded him, that it was so horrific that he took days to recover. And he claimed that this spirit that spoke to him said, it is difficult to kick against the goad, which is the most famous line of Dionysus, the very Greek god that the Christian Jesus Christ was conceived to replicate. There really is no difference. Horrific, nonsensical, and of course, even to the point of demon possession, Paul admits that he was demon possessed in his second letter to the Corinthians, written not long after his alleged encounter with the dark spirit. They're identical, folks. Same thing. And then the rhetoric that spewed out was initially rhetoric against his brethren. And you read Galatians. I mean, Galatians is a personal attack against everybody. Just as all of the Meccan surahs were a personal attack against everyone Muhammad knew and everyone who knew Muhammad. The same thing is true with the letters to the Galatians. They're the same. They're both conceived by the same spirit for the same purpose.
You know, when you read in Yashayahu, when he describes Halal bin Shakar, just that one name says it all. And
yeah,
you know, Islam, Islamic people, they consume that which is halal literally. And Yahweh right. told us. And when Shakar describes Christianity as a sun worship religion, and it's really that simple.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you can go to almost any supermarket chain today, and you'll find a display of Saffron Road food, and it says right on the front of it, halal. Now, they are not honest enough, because Muslims are never honest, to tell you that halal means purity in Islam, and that halal means that it's been blessed by imams, and that it's been processed according to Islamic traditions. They won't tell you that. No, in fact, you read the small print of the package, and they have a 1,400-year history of being wonderful to animals. And no, I mean, Muslims commit acts of bestiality with regularity. You know, the most famous authority on Islam, the highest-ranking Muslim of our time, would be the Ayatollah al-Khomeini. And he, in his little green book, he devotes chapters on the proper practice of bestiality. And so halal in Islam is that which is pure and holy. And yet, 1,000 years, almost 2,000 years before Islam is even conceived, Yahweh, through the prophet Yashayah, reveals that halal is Satan's first name. And the whole concept, the whole way that Satan is presented in Yashayah, rising out of Babylon, where was Islam conceived? Babylon. Where were the first Qurans written? Just outside of Babylon. Where was the first caliph headquartered? Just outside of Babylon. You can even look at Judaism, the Talmud. Where was it committed to paper? It's called the Babylonian Talmud. You know, and almost every aspect of Christianity is Babylonian. Lent, Easter, Queen of Heaven, Mother of God, a dying and resurrected son of the sun, Sunday worship, calling God the Lord, the Trinity, all of it's Babylonian. The crosses even emerged out of Babylon. Every aspect of it's Babylonian. And so in Yashayah, you're correct, it presents the nature of Satan. And what is Satan's motivation? What is Satan trying to achieve as he is presented in Yashayah? I think it's 14.
Well, it's like what you said yesterday. He wants the Temple Mount. He wants to be Allahu Akbar. He wants to be greater than Yahweh.
Right. He wants to be greater than the Most High.
He wants to be worshipped.
Right. He wants to be greater than the Most High. So confusing for people, because they think that Satan wants to be worshipped as Satan, so that an occult ceremony would be satanic. It's the opposite of satanic.
The term that they're using, they don't know, it's just like Yahweh. They don't know him because they don't know his name, and they don't know Allah bin Shakar because they don't know his name. If they knew what Satan meant, then all it is that something that's adverse, and it's adverse to what?
Adverse to Yahweh.
In this theme, it's adverse to Yahweh.
And actually adverse to your own soul. Yeah, Satan is not the devil's name. Halal bin Shakar is the devil's name. Satan is a descriptive title. It means the adversary. But the adversary's goal in life, his whole purpose for existing, is to shed the adversarial nomenclature and to be considered higher than God. Well, that's what Allahu Akbar means. That's the basis of Islam. The reason you can understand who Allah is, that he is Satan, is because of what Allah wishes to achieve through the Quran and Hadith and through the Islamic prayer, Allahu Akbar. He wants to be greater than Yahweh. And in Christianity, the God of Christianity is considered superior to the God that inspired the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, particularly the God of the Torah.
And there's no way you can practice Christianity without, when you start running in these religious circles, actually trying to find their God. I can relate to what Muhammad might have went through. I was going crazy. I was just literally losing my mind when I was thinking, oh, wretched man that I am. And why should, you know, he's telling me to pledge allegiance to these governments. And I'm like, if I lived in Germany, would I have pledged allegiance to Hitler?
Of course. According to Paul. Now, you know what's amazing about Pauline Christianity is that, well, Galatians is his first letter, and it lays out Pauline's the Pauline doctrine, which is that the Torah is to be rejected, the Torah is evil, the Torah enslaves, and that the covenant in the Torah is both antiquated and of the flesh, and therefore to be despised, as is circumcision, the sign of the covenant, but that Paul has conceived an entirely new covenant. And the new covenant is based on faith in the gospel of grace. That's Pauline doctrine. It's all laid out in the letter to the Galatians. But the letter that really cements Paul as the founder of the Christian religion is his letter to the Romans. And at the time that Paul wrote the letter to the Romans, Hadrian was literally part and parcel of what Rome represented. Hadrian had not come on the scene at the time of the letter to the Romans, but he would come to embrace what the Roman government ultimately became. In fact, most historians view Hadrian as among the greatest Roman emperors of all time, maybe the greatest. And we're going to consider what Hadrian did in a moment. So when we put it all together, and you realize that Paul told his faithful Christians that they should submit to their government, that all governments, without exception, were established by God himself for the good of the people. That's what he said. And he was writing the letter to the Romans. So he was absolutely saying that the Roman Empire was a product of God's will, that God himself had chosen the leaders and the path of the Roman Empire, and that Christians should follow Roman law. That's what he wrote. And yet, shortly after Paul's passing, Vespasian and Titus crucified hundreds of thousands of Jews, destroyed Yahweh's temple, raised it to the ground. They took the wealth they confiscated from the temple and used it to fund the most pagan, the most disgusting, the most despicable of all the buildings, the Colosseum in Rome. It was the Jewish slaves that they hauled out of Jerusalem, re-enslaving the very people that Yahweh had liberated to provide the labor to build the Colosseum. A spectacle to Roman paganism and cruelty. And he says, oh, that government, that's established by God. You ought to submit to them. And then Hadrian followed. Same Roman government. He was so inspired by God, he said, you know what we're going to do, Jews? I want you all to come back, because we're going to rebuild the Temple Mount. And when they came back, he says, now I'm going to spring my trap. We're going to rebuild it because we're going to rename Jerusalem after me. And the temple we're going to build, I mean, one big honking temple to me, Hadrian, and another one to Jupiter, the Roman god. Now, do you think that there is one chance in a trillion, billion, gazillion that God inspired that? Or we'd want you to follow along and say, yeah, that's right. Let's build a temple to the Roman emperor and worship him as God, and let's build another one to Jupiter. And all in the process, let's call the chosen people back and annihilate them. All governments, particularly the Roman government, authorized by God, you should submit to them. That's what Paul wrote. How is it that somebody who wrote something that obviously untrue, so inconsistent with what God actually said and wants and is like, cares about, could have founded a religion that has beguiled billions of souls? What it tells you is that Tommy was right. The Christians just don't think. If you were to think for a moment about Romans 13, about God establishing governments that we should be subjected to, starting with the Roman government, you'd reject him out of hand. You'd say that's an absolute nonsense. It's the antithesis of what's true. Or if you'd read Romans 7 about the woman being slave to the Torah, and how the Torah is dead to her and her dead husband. I mean, it is so irrational. It's the product of literally a pure insanity. Where Paul himself says, the only reason I'm a sexual pervert is because the Torah told me what a sexual pervert is, so that made me a sexual pervert. Did you read Romans 7, Romans 13? Or any part of Galatians. And if you do, and you've got the capacity to process information rationally, if evidence and reason means something to you, the very first thing you're going to do is reject Paul. And you reject Paul, all of Christianity disappears. Nothing in the religion is left. And that's because the actual Yahusha, there is no Jesus Christ. The actual Yahusha told you not to pay any attention to him, to instead look through him to the Father. Not to pray to him, but instead reach out to the Father. He said he was nothing but a diminished manifestation of the Father. And he was Torah observant. If you're Torah observant, you sure as hell can't be a Christian. You cease being a Christian when you follow Yahusha. The moment you come to know his name, and that his name means Yahweh saves, Christianity goes away. Paul had a fixation on unverifiable secret revelations, which is wholly inconsistent with Yahweh or Yahusha. And all Yahusha means is Yahweh saves. He had an affinity for mystery mythology, which was something that was very prevalent among Greeks and Romans of his day. That's how he was able to fool them. I mean, when you are promoting a religion where you're supposed to believe that God established a government that's wholly opposed to everything that God cares about, the only way that you can sell that kind of stupidity is to people that hate the same people that Rome hated. They hate the same people the Greeks hated. And that's what he did. That's the reason why he only spoke to Goyim. He spoke to Greeks and to Romans about the things that Greeks and Romans wanted to hear. And even then, he was rejected by vastly more people than accepted him. Anyway, in his letter to the Ephesians, and that's to what became the head of the Roman Empire, as the Roman Empire began to crumble. Evidently, God guiding it didn't do much good, because shortly after Paul, it was all downhill for the Roman Empire. They, and look, you think about the Roman Empire too, that God establishes their leaders. Caligula, for crying out loud, had been the leader of the Roman Empire just prior to Paul. In fact, as Paul was growing up, it was Caligula. And yet, this man could write that God appoints the governments, and you should obey them? Caligula, for crying out loud. And shortly thereafter, Nero. I mean, a man that built a giant colossus, gold-covered monument to himself, a statue of himself. I mean, a sick, perverted, narcissistic, idiot. And all you have to do is compare Rome immediately before, during, and immediately after Paul's letter to the Romans to his statements about Roman government in the 13th chapter of his letter to the Romans. All you have to do is compare the two. And if you're open to evidence and reason, contrast how beastly Rome was during the period of time of Paul's birth to shortly after Paul's death, to Paul's statements about submitting to government and God establishing them for good. That's all you have to do. And if you can come out of that thinking that Paul told the truth, then I would be careful about any decision you make the rest of your life, because you obviously can't think. Well, in Ephesus and to the Ephesians, Paul wrote, and I'm going to state this from the New American Standard Bible. It says, "If indeed you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace, which was given to me for you." So the grace, which is the cute little naked girls of frivolity and hospitality that Paul elevated to the dignitaries of his new religion. That was God made Paul the intermediary, is what Paul's saying here, that all of this was given by God to him on behalf of the faithful. "That by revelation there was made known to me the mystery, as I wrote before in brief. And by referring to this, when you read, you can understand my insight into the mystery of Christ, which in other generations was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed to his holy apostles and prophets in the Spirit, of which I was made a minister, to preach to the Gentiles the unfathomable riches of Christ, and to bring to light what is the administration of the mystery, which for ages has been hidden in God who created all things." So what's the purpose of the prophets? If the prophets weren't to reveal, what was their purpose? If the Torah wasn't to teach, why was it written? If God spoke the equivalent of thousands of pages of inspired writings to humankind, why was this a mystery? If Yahusha, as the name implies, the corporeal manifestation of Yahweh, diminished and set apart from him, how could this not be known? What is this? How could there be a mystery? What on earth were all the prophets talking about? Why did Yahusha, when he was asked any question about himself, tell the questioner to go consider what the Torah, prophets, and Psalms have to say about him? If he said, "You'll find out everything you need to know about me in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms," how in the hell could there have been a mystery? Why would God conceal something if it was important when he spent all of his time revealing? Is he the God of darkness rather than light? Funny thing, though. Yahweh's prophets never spoke of mysteries. And to the contrary, Yahweh used them to dispel myths. The disciples never spoke of mysteries either, nor did Yahusha. For those who are open to him, Yahweh is an open book. Open his Torah. You'll find him there. In fact, the only reason that God authored his Torah was to reveal himself to us so that we might come to know him. And hopefully you're like Tommy, like me. When you come to know the God revealed in the Torah, you'll come to like him. Just take it from there. King Dod, who was more commonly known as David, was inspired to share the following insight into the nature and purpose of the Torah. Now, I know that Dod was inspired, and I know for certain that he was inspired for two reasons. Everything that Yahweh would come to say about him, which is so uplifting, so loving, so supportive. And second, the most accurate depiction of what Yahusha did when it mattered on Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim in 33 CE, which was year 4000 Yah. It's not found in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, but instead found in Psalm 22 and 88, both of which came from Dod. His depictions of history 1,000 years removed from him, his eyewitness accounts of what Yahusha would endure on Passover, unyeasted bread, and firstborn children in year 4000 Yah, are vastly more comprehensive and accurate than anything you will find, even among the two eyewitnesses, Matanyah and Yahuchanan. I know for certain that he was inspired. He wrote, Yahweh's Torah is complete and entirely perfect, returning, restoring, and transforming the soul. Yahweh's eternal testimony is trustworthy and reliable, making understanding and obtaining wisdom simple for the open-minded. The religion of Christianity, particularly Pauline doctrine, is wholly incompatible with that statement. It says the opposite. It claims the opposite. Paul wrote in this very letter to the Galatians that Yahweh's Torah cannot save. Paul is claiming that it is responsible for returning, restoring, and transforming the soul. Paul's letter to the Galatians says that the Torah has been done away with, and that his testimony is what matters now, meaning that he is subtracting from it the entirety of it and adding all new material to it. So the Torah had to be, according to Paul, imperfect and incomplete. The opposite of what God is claiming here. Paul attacks everything that Yahweh says, but yet this says that what everything that Yahweh says is eternal, trustworthy, reliable. Paul claims that there's been great mysteries that were unknown to the sons of men, that he was the first to understand and now is the great bastion of explaining the mystery. And yet, Yahweh's eternal testimony is not only trustworthy and reliable, makes understanding and obtaining wisdom simple for the open-minded. Where there is understanding, there isn't mystery. Few things are so essential to life as this. Few things this important are so succinct. And that is why you've seen this statement before from Yahweh, and you'll see it again. It's one of my favorites. But let's assume, for the sake of argument, that the murderer, Paul, who by his own account was forced to become an apostle during a rather nasty encounter with a prodding and debilitating spirit on the road to Damascus, was a special case, and that he was too remarkable an individual to learn about God the way the rest of us mere mortals have done, by observing the Torah, as God suggested. It's certainly God's prerogative to teach someone individually if he so desires. The disciples had some group instruction, most of which they made public. And their subsequent message, like Paul's, was wholly consistent with everything Yahweh and Yahushua proclaimed publicly. So they claimed exactly the opposite. Everything they said was consistent with what Yahushua said. They quoted him vociferously. And everything Yahushua said was consistent with what Yahweh said. And yet with Paul, it was just the opposite. So if God had a private meeting with Paul, why was there no prophetic affirmation of it? Why was everything they acknowledged discussed, allegedly discussed, the opposite of what had been conveyed by so many others, so many times before? I mean, ultimately, folks, every time Yahweh spoke through a prophet, he included prophecy so we could verify that it was true. So what do you suppose, if this revelation actually occurred, as Paul professes, that there isn't a single quote from Yahusha in the whole colossum of Paul's letters? Rather than write, Yahusha said, Paul wrote, but I say. Beyond not citing anything from their mythical private meeting, the self-proclaimed apostle only quoted one snippet out of context of something Yahusha said publicly. And in his lone citation, Paul bungled the quote. As such, Paul's entire premise is ludicrous. We have Tommy back. Hello, Tommy.
Hello, yeah. I just wanted to go back to what you were saying about those. It's so obvious that Paul was not inspired by Yahweh. And
yes.
Was an impressionable man, and Yahweh's Torah made an impression on him.
Yeah.
And when he shares the impression that Yahweh made on him, he speaks the truth about Yahweh. He's not in league with Hasatan. He's sharing Yahweh's words.
Yeah. Matter of fact, when Yahweh speaks through a prophet, you get a little flavor of the prophet's persona. That's the reason why Yahweh chooses to work through people, is that it gives the prophet has a persona, and you get a little flavor of what Dode was like, a little flavor of what Moshe was like, a little flavor of what Abraham was like, for example, even though they're inspired words. And I'm going to tell you that Dode was impassioned, but the fact is he was the greatest intellect in all of human history. And you can tell that from his writing styles. And Paul was an absolute and complete dunderhead. I mean, he couldn't string four words together in a sensible way. But the most important way that you tell whether or not Yahweh inspired someone, David, for example, versus Paul, the founder of the Christian religion, is prophecy. There's not a single accurate prophecy in the entirety of Paul's letters. And Dode's Psalms are filled with thousands of precisely accurate prophecies. Just compare the two.
Well, wasn't he observing Yahweh's Torah? I mean, he observed the same thing that Yahweh observed. Yahweh observed sevens.
Right.
The same thing that we're observing right now. We're observing the seventh day that it'll be upon us pretty soon. And that doesn't make me a prophet. It doesn't make me inspired. But you know what? I was inspired by someone. I was inspired by Yahweh's words. I was inspired by Yahweh's Torah. And as an imperfect implement, that's what anyone who's inspired by Yahweh's words and loves him wants to do. They want to share his words.
Yeah. But when you come to like what Yahweh has to say and like him as an individual and what he has to convey in his Torah, one of the first things that happens beyond liking what you're reading is you come to understand who he is and what he's offering. And then you respond to it. And once you respond to it and participate in the covenant family, everything changes for you. You know, you revel in the truth. You revel in the family. You revel in your relationship with Yahweh. And you do. You want to share it with others. But what we share is not some mystery that's been revealed to us. We never share a mystery that's been revealed to us. I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I've never had a mystery revealed to me and don't want one. You know, I'm very happy to study the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, because every day I do, I learn something. But it's hugely different learning something and being inspired by something that Yahweh made available to all of us, that what he said is wholly complete and totally perfect. So I'm very content, yeah, happy to look at that which is perfect and complete and to understand it. And then to share what I learned. That's, you could spend 1,000 lifetimes doing that and never grow weary of it.
I love it myself.
Yeah, what I find too, Tommy, is that I can go through the same story in the Torah. You know, it might be the story of Abraham, the story of Noah, the story of Yahweh encountering Moshe for the first time. Any one of the occurrences in the garden with Adam and then later with Adam and Chawa. I can go through any of those stories a second time and learn twice as much as I learned the first time. And then I can go through it a third time and learn a whole lot more. And each time I go through it, there's another insight, another revelation, another layer of understanding. I find that it's never ending.
Oh, it's fun.
Yes. And you know something?
It's never ending.
Yeah, like the eighth day. And it's all consistent. It's all lovable. It's all rational. It's all dependable. It's always consistent. And then over there you have Paul. And it's none of those things. Thank you, Tommy, for participating today. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to being back with you on Monday. May Yah bless.